Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 322 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And the title of this podcast is going to be an introduction to general embryology. Introduction to general embryology. And before I start this podcast, again, I just want to make an announcement. For those of you taking step 2, CK step 3, sometime soon, I do offer a 20-hour review course. It's going to be taking place on Friday and Saturday this week. And then an MBME test taking strategies course, which is going to be taking place tomorrow. So if that's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more details on that. Again, I've had many people take these courses and have done pretty well. Okay, so let's just jump right into it. And really, like, my goal today is to go through embryology from the very beginning to basically when the child is essentially, you know, placed in the, you know, basically the child baby comes out. Again, just many of these things, again, people just memorize things. But again, a lot of this thing is just being able to, I feel like embryology, the name of the game in embryology is just being able to know how things logically happen and what triggers one thing after the other. So again, just think of this again as a nice survey, nice just introduction to general embryology. I will emphasize quite a number of details that you definitely do need to know for your exam. So let's just get right into it, right? So the major events of early life, right, in a child, right, for the most part, you form your gametes first, right? And then after you form your gametes, you're going to have fertilization between the egg and the sperm, and then you're going to form a zygote. And then that zygote is going to implant in the uterus. And then that zygote is just going to keep cleaving. All of this stuff happens in week one. By week two, you then have an embryo that has two layers formed. By week three, you have an embryo with three layers formed. By week four, you start having all these body folding processes beginning to happen. That's just kind of like a nice overview of what actually happens, right? So let's just hit on those processes one by one and talk about the high yield things you need to know for your USMLE exams, right? So the thing is, in a developing embryo, the gonads of that embryo, like the testes, the ovaries, they actually begin to form right around the fifth week of development. So how does this process happen? Well, if you really think about it, there are some structures, right? So if you kind of look at the fetus and you look at the posterior abdominal wall, right? So like look in the back of the fetus around the abdominal area. There are some structures in that region that are called the urogenital ridge, right? They're called the urogenital ridge, right? They actually derive from mesoderm. And really, if you look at this term, urogenital ridge, it should basically give you some clues that these structures, right, they give rise to genital related entities and kidneys. Remember, kidneys, urine, uro, right? Kind of put two and two together there, right? So kidney related structures, genital related structures, they actually come from these urogenital ridges. That's why many times when people have like reproductive organ anatomical problems, they also will usually have problems with their kidneys or with their collecting systems. So the thing is, these are urogenital ridges. They're actually not going to be unique in the beginning in becoming testes or ovaries. They actually have the ability to become one or the other, right? So the thing that makes that determination, right, as to, oh, you know what, you're going to become an ovary, you know what, you're going to become a testes, there are actually some cells that come from the yolk sac. Those cells actually derive from endoderm, right? So there are some endodermally derived cells that come from the yolk sac that will then tell these urogenital ridges, you're gonna become an ovary, you're gonna become a testes, right? So the thing is, these cells that are, you know, derived from endoderm that come from the yolk sac, they could either have an XX chromosome, right? Obviously that's female, or they can have an XY chromosome, that's male. So the thing is, they basically come from, again, the yolk sac to the urogenital ridge. The highway that kind of gets them there is the umbilical cord, right? And one thing I guess maybe I should say is, the urogenital ridge, if you really think about it, the default program is to become female genital structures. But again, these endodermally derived cells have a big say in that process, right? So again, they'll come from the yolk sac through the umbilical cord to the urogenital ridge, right? So if those endodermally derived cells are like XY, well, The presence of that Y chromosome is what will then determine that, oh, you know what, go ahead and form male genital structures. The thing is, the presence of that Y chromosome is what tells you, go, your genital reach, become male. Versus if there is an absence of the Y chromosome, that's what determines, oh, your genital reach, become female. So it's very important to understand that, you know, again, that Y chromosome is what makes you form male genital structures. But the thing is, in addition to that Y chromosome being there, you do need to produce certain things so that you can shut down the urogenital ridge from becoming like that pre-programmed female thing, right? So that's how many of these things work. And I'll talk about these specific factors, right? So the thing is, if you look at the Y chromosome, so why is the Y chromosome important? The thing is, if you look at the Y chromosome, it actually has this tiny little genetic segment called the SRY region. Many of us have heard about it, right? SRY. SRY literally just means sex determining region on the Y chromosome, right? So essentially, this SRY region, it actually codes for a protein that's called testis determining factor. So the thing is, this testis determining factor, as those cells that come from the endoderm, from that yolk sac, right, as they come towards the urogenital ridge, right, the release of this testis determining factor by those cells is what converts that undifferentiated urogenital ridge to a differentiated testes, right? And remember, in the testes, there are two very important cell types, right? There's the Leydig cell, which is very important, and then there's the Sertoli cell. And what exactly do these Leydig cells do? These Leydig cells, excuse me, they make testosterone, right? And then they also make a more potent derivative of testosterone that's known as DHT. Remember, the thing that makes you convert testosterone to DHT is 5-alpha reductase. Remember, DHT is responsible for the growth of the prostate. That's why we use 5-alpha reductase inhibitors like finasteride and dutasteride to treat BPH, right? Benign prostatic hyperplasia, right? So again, Leydig cells, they make testosterone, right? And again, they can make its very potent cousin, DHT, dihydrotestosterone. So basically, by releasing these testosterone, right, again, it's going to convert other elements of the urogenital ridge, again, to male genital structures. But remember, so that's objective number one. Objective number two comes from the Sertoli cells. The Sertoli cells, they actually make Mullerian inhibiting factor. Mullerian inhibiting factor, sometimes it's called anti-Mullerian hormone on MBM exams. What it does is it basically prevents the urogenital ridge from becoming those pre-programmed female structures, right? So again, to become a guy, you need two things to happen. One, you need to become male, and then two, you need to prevent female development, right? Again, that comes from Mullerian inhibiting factor, also called anti-Mullerian hormone, that comes from the Sertoli cells, right? And one thing I will just say is those cells that I talked about, again, that are endodermally derived, that come from the yolk sac, and then they migrate through the umbilical cord to the urogenital ridge, they actually become gametes in the end. Those are the things that ultimately become your gametes, right? So again, those cells, just to summarize, they will come from the yolk sac. They are derived from endoderm, right? They're like primordial germ cells. They're derived from endoderm. They'll come through the yolk, they'll come from the yolk sac, go through the umbilical cord, go to the posterior abdominal wall in the fetus, right, which contains the urogenital ridge, right? And then that, with the presence of testis determining factor, right, and Mullerian inhibiting factor, you go down that testis pathway, you form the male genital system, right? But if you don't have those factors, you go down the ovary pathway and form the female genital system, right, from the paramesonephric duct, right, the Mullerian duct. Remember, the duct for the guys is the Wolfian duct, right, is the Wolfian duct. Okay, so now, let's say fertilization happens, right? Although again, remember, for fertilization to happen, the sperm must meet with the egg, right? So I think maybe one thing that may be helpful is to kind of talk about the process of gametogenesis in females, right? I think that's the one that's probably especially important. The males can always be discussed later, right? But remember, those germ cells, right, those primordial germ cells, they are diploid, right? They are called oogonia. Right? Oogonia, like double O-G-O-N-I-A, right? So oogonia, right? So they are diploid, right? So they are 2N, they have 46 chromosomes in them, right? So the thing that happens is you have the process of DNA replication that will happen at first, and then you'll form primary oocytes, right? You'll form primary oocytes. Remember, those primary oocytes contain 46 chromosomes, but now you're at the 4N stage because you've basically duplicated each chromosome, right? Now, The thing that happens is that you have an arrest at this primary oocyte phase. You actually have an arrest in meiosis one, right? In prophase of meiosis one, until the lady hits puberty, right? And then when puberty happens, right, you then have meiosis two begin to happen, right? So that primary oocyte will divide and form secondary oocytes, right? Remember, those secondary oocytes are going to have 23 chromosomes. They're going to be 2N, right? 23 chromosomes, they're going to be 2N, right? And the thing is, in forming that secondary oocyte, because you think that, oh, divine, from the primary oocyte, which was 46, 4N, we will form two secondary oocytes. No, that's not true. You actually form one secondary oocyte, and then the second thing that is supposed to become the second secondary oocyte becomes a polar body, right? So that one secondary oocyte that survives, right, then starts dividing again. But again, it's going to be arrested one more time. It's going to be arrested in meiosis two, right? It's going to be arrested in meiosis two, in metaphase of meiosis two. So remember, the first arrest happens in prophase of meiosis one. The second arrest happens in metaphase of meiosis two. Right? And when that arrest then happens, you then need to wait for the sperm to meet the egg, right? When the sperm meets the egg, then that secondary oocyte will then complete meiosis two, and then you'll form the mature ovum that is 23 chromosomes and is 1N. It's haploid, right? It's haploid. And then you'll actually form a second polar body as well. So you don't form two mature ova from one secondary oocyte. No, you form one mature ovum, right? And a second polar body after fertilization, right? So the sperm needs to meet the egg for the egg to complete meiosis two, to basically proceed from metaphase of meiosis two, right? So let's say fertilization then happens, right? So usually, where does fertilization happen? Usually fertilization is going to happen like in the ampulla of the fallopian tube. Remember, another name for the fallopian tube on NBM exams is the oviduct, right? So you have fertilization between the sperm and the egg, right? Happens in the ampulla of the fallopian tube, right? Then you're going to form a zygote, and that zygote is obviously diploid. Right? The thing that happens with the zygote is that it begins to divide very, very, very rapidly, right? The thing is, in regular mitosis that we're used to learning, right? Regular mitosis, as you're having replication happen, then you have an increase, like a doubling of the size of the cytoplasm. That actually does not happen at all with mitosis of the zygote. The zygote actually has this kind of cell division called cleavage division. Basically, you're increasing the number of cells, but you're actually not increasing the amount of cytoplasm. That's very high yield to know. You're increasing the number of cells, but you're actually not increasing the amount of cytoplasm, right? You're not increasing the amount of cytoplasm, right? So the thing is, the zygote, it keeps dividing until it becomes a solid ball of cells. That solid ball of cells is the 16-cell phase. That's what's known as the morula, okay? It's the 16-cell phase. It's known as the morula. And then the thing that will happen is you keep having, again, more division. The thing is, as you keep dividing, you then, that morula will then form like a hollow, like it's almost like a hollow, right? Like a cylinder, right? And inside that cylinder, there's like fluid in it, right? So because there's fluid in it, it's almost like a cystic structure. It's called a blastocyst, right? The thing is, that blastocyst is actually like the first level of specialization in the embryo. That's very high yield to know. That blastocyst is actually the first level of specialization in the embryo, right? So the thing is, the two cell types that make up that blastocyst, right? You will have an inner cell mass, because basically that blastocyst has like two populations of cells. First population of cells, they are called the inner cell mass, right? So you're going to have the inner cell mass that is known as the embryoblast, right? The thing is, whenever you see the term blast in something, it means that it has the ability to give rise to other stuff, right? And since this is the embryo blast, that means, oh, it has the potential to give rise to the embryo, which it does, right? And then you have the outer cell mass, right? Which is known as the trophoblast, right? Troph means nutrition, right? I mean, you've probably learned of trophism from maybe like biology in college or whatever, right? But the troph means nutrition, right? So that trophoblast is what will ultimately form the placenta, right? So again, you start at the 16-cell phase, the morula. Then it keeps dividing, and then you form a hollow ball of cells, right? That hollow ball of cells has fluid in the center, and then that hollow ball of cells has two cell populations, an inner cell mass called the embryoblast, which becomes the embryo, and then an outer cell mass, which becomes the trophoblast. Again, remember, the word troph means nutrition, so it's going to form the placenta. Now, right around day six, right, those trophoblastic cells, the thing they actually do is they invade the endometrial lining of the lady's uterus, right? They will invade the endometrial lining. And again, when they invade, those trophoblasts will then form two more cell lines, right? So the first cell line they form is something called the cytotrophoblast, right? Look at the name, cytotrophoblast. Cyto means cells, right? These cells actually have the ability to just keep undergoing continuous mitosis, continuous mitosis, continuous mitosis. But then you also form the syncytial trophoblast, right? The thing is, the syncytial trophoblast cells, remember the word syncytium. Syncytium means like a network of cells, right? Syncytium. Syncytial trophoblast cells, they're actually the cells that have direct contact with the mom's uterus. This is very high yield to know, right? This is extremely high yield to know. Between the cytotrophoblast and the syncytial trophoblast, the one that has direct contact with mom's cells, with mom's uterus, with the endometrial lining of the mom's uterus, are the syncytial trophoblast, right? So the thing is, so you may be like, okay, Divine, what's the point of the cytotrophoblast? Well, the cytotrophoblast, their job is to actually replenish the syncytial trophoblast. And syncytial trophoblast, by the way, is spelled as syncytiotrophoblast. So syncytiotrophoblast. Syncytial trophoblast, right? So the cytotrophoblast is the thing that replenishes your syncytial trophoblast. But then the job of the syncytial trophoblast is actually to produce beta HCG, right? It's actually to produce beta HCG, right? Remember, the job of beta HCG is to maintain the corpus luteum, right? Because remember, the corpus luteum on its own is almost like one friend helping out the other. Syncytial trophoblast will produce beta HCG, which maintains the corpus luteum. And then the corpus luteum then makes progesterone. Look at the name, progesterone. It is progestational. The progesterone from the syncytial trophoblast is what then maintains the endometrial lining, right? And the thing is, that beta HCG that comes from the syncytial trophoblast, that's actually what you detect in the urine pregnancy test, right? So if you notice, if you do a urine pregnancy test like at day 2 of conception, you're not going to see anything, right? You need to wait till around day 6, day 7, when the syncytial trophoblast starts producing beta HCG for you to detect pregnancy through the urine pregnancy test. Again, this stuff is very, very high yield to know, right? Very, very high yield to know. So again, remember, zygote, right, is diploid, 46 chromosomes. It keeps dividing, right? Day 4, you have a group of 16 cells, that's the morula, right? And then day 5, you're from the blastocyst. The blastocyst has an inner cell mass, which is the embryoblast, and an outer cell mass, which is the trophoblast. Day 6, that's right around where implantation happens, right? So again, just very important to make sure you understand these things. If you do, the thing about embryology is, embryology just involves a lot of processes, right? A lot of just daunting processes sometimes. But if you have it organized and you repeat it often enough, you begin to get it into your memory easily. That's why you see I'm repeating things and summarizing things over and over again, over and over again, right? So now let's keep marching on, right? So we've dealt with week 1, right? Now week 2, right? Remember I said earlier at the beginning that in week 2, you form a two-layered embryo. That's a nice way to remember that. In week 2, you form a two-layered embryo, right? So what in the world happens in week 2? The thing is, in week 2, remember those two cell populations I talked about? I've already talked about the trophoblast and how it forms the cytotrophoblast and the syncytial trophoblast. The thing is, in week 2, you have the embryoblast, right? Remember, the embryoblast was the inner cell mass, right? So that embryoblast actually differentiates into two cell types, right? So remember, the trophoblast differentiated into two cell types, cytotrophoblast and syncytial trophoblast. The embryoblast on its own differentiates into two cell types, right? The two cell types, one is the epiblast. The epiblast is like right on the top, right? Remember, whenever something is on top, that's the dorsal orientation anatomically, right? And then the second cell population it forms is the hypoblast. Hypoblast is below, it's ventral, right? So really, to be honest with you, the best way to visualize this, because this is an audio podcast, but I still want you to understand, is just think of these things as having some kind of vertical orientation. The thing that is on top, right? An upside down orientation. The thing that is on top is the epiblast, right? Is at the top. And when something is on top, it's dorsal. The hypoblast is at the bottom. It's ventral, right? So the thing is, it's actually very high yield to know that the epiblast is what ultimately gives rise to all the cells that will eventually constitute the embryo, right? The epiblast is the thing that ultimately gives rise to all the cells that will constitute the embryo. Right? Now, the thing is, For the most part, that epiblast and hypoblast, again, they're just stacked on top of each other, right? They just form these two distinct cell layers. The thing is, at this point, we don't know what is the head of the fetus. We don't know what is the tail of the fetus, right? We don't know any portion that, oh, you know, this side is the head, this side is the tail. We don't know, right? So how can we fix that problem? How can we establish some kind of polarity like, oh, you know what? This will be the fetal head. Oh, you know what? This will be the fetal tail. The thing that happens is that though that epiblast and hypoblast that are stacked on top of each other, there is actually a point where they fuse, right? So like, just think of, again, like two arrays of cells. And then there's one point in that array where they really, really fuse together. That place where they fuse together is called the prechordal plate, right? The prechordal plate. The thing is, this point of fusion, right, is what will ultimately determine where your future head or your future mouth is going to be, right? Really, like, this is like the thing that gives rise to like, oh, you know what? We're going to define what is the head of this fetus. We're going to define what is the tail of this fetus, right? So the thing is, the body is almost like, you know what? We have epiblast on top. We have hypoblast at the bottom. Let's just pick a spot. Bam. And from this spot, we'll then define every other thing of the body in relation to this one spot, right? So that one spot is called the prechordal plate, right? It's called the prechordal plate. Again, that's very high yield to know, and that's very high yield to understand. Again, it's a point of fusion between the epiblast cells, which are dorsal, which are on top, and the hypoblast cells, which are ventral, which are below. Remember, the epiblast and hypoblast, they are derived from the embryoblast, which was that inner cell mass I talked about in relation to the blastocyst, right? So that's essentially what happens in week two, right? So what in the world happens in week three? Well, in week three, remember I said in week two, you formed a two-layered embryo. But in week three, you're going to form a three-layered embryo, right? You're going to form a three-layered embryo. And again, remember what I said earlier. I said that, oh, between the epiblast and the hypoblast is the epiblast that is going to give rise to all of the future embryo, right? So the thing is, again, let's continue our journey from that prechordal plate, right? So remember, the prechordal plate is where the future mouth and the future head is going to be, right? So once you know that, oh, this is the place where the future mouth, this is where the future head is going to be, you know that that has to be the cranial part of said fetus, right? And then any other thing that is like distal to that, you can then begin to make denotations as to, oh, this is this, this is this, this is this for the fetus, right? So what happens to that cranial part, this prechordal plate part? Well, the thing that happens is that the cranial axis of the fetus, right, it keeps enlarging. In fact, it grows a lot bigger than the caudal axis, right? It grows a lot bigger than the caudal axis. So the thing is, if you really look at a fetus, right, if you, let's say you become a new parent or whatever, right, and you're looking at the baby at like 8 weeks, 9 weeks, 10 weeks, usually you see like a part of the baby's body that is very big. That is actually the head. Again, a lot of that starts around week three. The baby's head grows a lot faster than the rest of the body. But obviously, that's not going to be the case for the whole of pregnancy, right? That's obviously not going to be the case for the whole of pregnancy. So the thing is, so again, that prechordal plate tells us where the head is, right? So that's the cranial axis of the fetus. The caudal axis of the fetus, where we're going to form the tail, in a region around that caudal axis of the epiblast. One thing that happens is you begin to have some cells dying, right? So let's say, again, we have the epiblast on top. We have the hypoblast at the bottom. Some cells around the epiblast, they just die, right? The thing is, when cells die, the body then reabsorbs them. And that creates a hole. Literally, that creates a hole, right? That creates a hole. This is very high yield to know, right? So again, in the epiblast, somewhere around the caudal axis, right, around the tail region of the epiblast, some cells begin to die. Some cells die. As they die, you create a hole, right, an invagination. So the thing that then happens is that the place where those cells die, right, gives you a structure, right? A structure begins to form within that epiblast called the primitive streak, right? It is actually very important to think of this primitive streak as just like a highway that is being created. I'll say that again.
This place where you have the selective death of cells of the epiblast, it creates a hole. That hole essentially forms a highway, right? Think of that fancy highway as being the primitive streak, right? Because basically that highway you create, that hole you've created, allows some cells from the epiblast above to gain access to the region of the hypoblast. They use that hole. It's almost like they fall from the top and fall towards the bottom, right? So you create a fancy highway of sorts for those epiblast cells, which are dorsally oriented, they're on top, to gain access to the region around the hypoblast below, which is ventral, right? So the thing is, cells from the epiblast, right? Again, they migrate through this primitive streak hole, right? They migrate downwards. They migrate downwards, right? And the thing is, as they migrate downwards, they'll begin to push the hypoblast out of the way. Remember, I said that it's these epiblast cells that ultimately form the embryo in the future, right? You see these E structures forming the embryo, right? Embryoblast, epiblast, right? You see, they both start with E's. That's a nice way to keep that straight, right? So those epiblast cells, they migrate through this highway. They migrate downwards. So they are migrating ventrally, right? And then they push the hypoblast cells out of the way, right? So those cells, those epiblast cells that come in through that hole and displace the hypoblast, they then take over that layer that was previously occupied by the hypoblast. Those epiblast cells that take over that layer will ultimately form endoderm, right? They will ultimately form endoderm. I'll say that again. They will ultimately form endoderm. That's the first layer, right? Now, remember I said that, remember I said earlier on that, again, you have the epiblast on top. Again, I'm repeating myself so many times just to make sure that you fix these facts in your mind, right? And you understand it. Remember I said that, initially, you had the, in week two, you had the epiblast, you had the on top, right? Dorsal. And then you had the hypoblast on the bottom, ventral. And we said that they fused in one spot. And that place where they fused is the precordal plate. Well, the thing is, they fused in one spot. That means they did not fuse in other spots. So there is literally some space between the epiblast and the hypoblast. So the thing is, that potential space that existed between the epiblast and the hypoblast, again, some of those cells that are coming in through that fancy highway, through that primitive streak, they come and fill in that in-between space. The cells that fill in that in-between space are actually the cells that become mesoderm, right? Those are actually the cells that become mesoderm, right? So again, we've already talked about the cells that fill in the space that was occupied by the hypoblast. That's endoderm. And then the space between epiblast and hypoblast, the epiblast cells that fill up that space, that have traveled through that highway, right? That highway of the primitive streak, become mesoderm, right? And then the cells, right, that fill up that, you know, that middle space, that become mesoderm, they actually arrange themselves in a defined orientation. They arrange themselves like in a lateral orientation and in a medial orientation. So some cells are closer to the middle. They are closer to that primitive streak. And then some other cells are lateral. They're on the sides, right? They're on the sides. The thing is, those mesoderm cells that are the most medial, right? Again, remember, this is the space that was between the epiblast and hypoblast. So those mesoderm cells that are the most medial, they actually form a structure, right? That structure is known as the notochord, right? You'll see that the notochord is extremely important, right? And actually, it's very high yield to know for the USMLE exams that that notochord is what becomes the nucleus pulposus of the intervertebral disc in the adult, right? Now, those cells of the epiblast that did not migrate, because remember I said that, some cells of the epiblast, they come down through that hole, that highway of the primitive streak. They displace the hypoblast. Those become endoderm. Some stay in that space between the endoderm and the mesoderm. Between the epiblast and hypoblast, they become mesoderm. And we said that the ones in the middle of that mesoderm layer form the notochord, right? Because some of them are arranged medially. They're very close to the primitive streak. Some are arranged more laterally, right? Now, the thing is, the epiblast cells that remain at the very top, that just never migrated in the first place, they actually acquire a new name. We call them ectoderm, right? We call them ectoderm. And the thing is, just like mesoderm, some of those cells in the ectoderm layer, we actually define them with respect to their location along like a medial lateral axis, right? Around the medial lateral axis. So the thing is, those cells from the epiblast that did not migrate that are most medial, the ones that are closest to the primitive streak, they actually become neuroectoderm. I'll say that again. They become neuroectoderm. Again, this should make sense because that notochord, remember the notochord I said, is like almost like the most medial part of your mesoderm layer. That notochord, it actually releases factors during the embryonic period that causes differentiation of the ectodermal cells just above it, right? So just in the middle, just above it, right? In that epiblast layer, right? And those cells become neuroectoderm, right? Remember, the neuroectoderm is what will ultimately give rise to all the cells of the CNS and the cells of the retina, right? And then the thing is, those cells that are ectoderm, that are most lateral, right? If you're going lateral, away from the primitive streak, those are cells that actually become the neurocrest cells, right? They become the neurocrest cells. And remember, those lateral lying cells, right? They're on the periphery of this. Because remember, I said neuroectoderm forms the CNS, the central. That's literally like a nice way to remember that. Oh, central nervous system, neuroectoderm, it's in the center, it's in the middle, right? And then if you go further lateral, you're having cells on the periphery, right? They're literally like on the periphery of the central nervous system, right? That's why it's called the peripheral nervous system, right? So you see, many things in life, they just make sense if you understand it. In fact, I'm smiling as I'm explaining this now. Like, it just makes so much more sense as you begin to actually like, wow, oh, so this term central nervous system didn't come out of thin air. This term peripheral nervous system didn't come out of thin air, right? So again, those cells that lie lateral, right? They give rise to the peripheral nervous system and they give rise to Schwann cells, right? And the thing is, the most lateral of all these ectoderm cells, many times we describe them best as surface ectoderm, right? As surface ectoderm. So the thing is, this overall process where we have formed the endoderm, right, that's layer one, the mesoderm, that's layer two, and the ectoderm, that's layer three, that process is referred to as gastrulation. Gastrulation as a process happens in week three of development, right? And then the thing that then ultimately happens is, again, that flat embryo that's arranged in a vertical axis, as I've described earlier, right? It then folds laterally to form a tube within a tube within a tube, right? So this flat embryo, it folds laterally, right? And you form a tube within a tube within a tube. Obviously, the innermost tube is going to be the endoderm. The outermost tube is going to be the ectoderm. The tube in the middle is going to be the mesoderm, right? So again, remember, the ectoderm and endoderm, they're actually the things that all form epithelial tissue, right? The mesoderm is what ultimately forms connective tissue, right? It literally connects the ectoderm to the endoderm, right? And again, the thing is, unfortunately, the embryonic layers, you kind of need to know their derivatives for the USMLE exams. But again, I will encourage you to not just straight up try to memorize them. The thing is, as you learn, as you're studying for your USMLE Step 1 exam, as you learn the different like embryology of the different body systems, try to pick up those derivatives in that format. That's like the best way to remember those things, right? But let me give you some useful generalizations that I feel will help you out with a lot of the reasoning. The thing is, first things first, ectoderm and endoderm form epithelium. That's a given. Mesoderm forms connective tissue, right? So things like, think of the connective tissues in your body, right? Bone, muscle, cartilage, blood vessels, dermis, the heart, right? Those things are all derived from mesoderm, right? They are all derived from mesoderm, right? That's very high yield to know, right? And then the endoderm, remember, it forms the epithelial lining of the major tracts of your body, right? Like your respiratory tract, the lining of your GI tract, even a portion of your urogenital tract comes from endoderm, right? And then remember, the ectoderm, which is on the outside, right, is going to form the epithelial lining of the skin, right? So like your epidermis, remember, your epidermis is what comes from ectoderm. Your dermis is not derived from ectoderm. Your dermis is derived from mesoderm, right? And then again, that ectoderm also gives rise to a lot of neural structures, right? It also, you know, gives rise to neural structures, right? So again, let's just summarize, right? So we start off at the egg and sperm come together from the zygote. Zygote becomes morula. Morula becomes a blastocyst, which has an inner cell mass that becomes the epiblast and an outer cell mass that becomes a trophoblast. The trophoblast gives rise to the cytotrophoblast and the syncytiotrophoblast. The inner cell mass, right, or the embryoblast, gives rise to the hypoblast, which becomes not useful, and the epiblast, which undergoes the process of gastrulation in week three to form ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here, but that's pretty much a nice overview of general embryology, so that you can just know, like, because again, the body just did not happen randomly, right? You know, it kind of came from somewhere. So I'm going to go ahead and pause here. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer review courses for the USMLE exams. If you're interested in any of them, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more information. But then I do have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. That's where I post the videos that I make. Subscribe to that. And if you hit that bell, right, you'll get a notification whenever I make a video. But if you want the slides though associated with those videos, go to the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com. And the thing is, if you subscribe to the website, whenever I make a new podcast, you will actually get an email notification. And then I do have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. Again, if you subscribe to those, you get my new podcasts in your podcaster feed. At least the most recent 150. It's a rule I've tried to circumvent. There's really no way around it, right? So if you want all my podcasts from episode one, then you need to go to the website. Everything from episode one is on the website. You don't need any logins. You can access them, you can download them, right? But again, one thing that'd be helpful is if you subscribe to the website, that support definitely helps me. But then in addition to that, if I make a new podcast, you'll get an email notification. And then, again, many of you are used to my life lessons. I do have a new website that I formed, Divine Intervention Life Lessons. In fact, I make podcasts. Again, many of you listening to this podcast know that I'm a Christian, right? So I put like some just very short podcasts. Pretty much all of them are going to be less than 10 minutes for the most part. I've made 3 episodes right now. You know, episode one was on focus. Episode 2 was on diligence. Episode 3, which I just made this morning, is on stewardship. So if you subscribe to those, I have it on Apple Podcasts, right? And again, the website is divineinterventionlifelessons.com. If you have any questions, just feel free to reach out to me and I'll be more than happy to point you in the right direction. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I hope you've gained a lot from this and you have a very thorough, solid understanding of embryology. So I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you. God bless you.